grab your Bibles and turn to the book of Zephaniah. That's why I'm telling you this now, so that you have time to find it. The book of Zephaniah. That's one of the minor prophets, part of the book of the 12. They're in the very back of the Old Testament. If you're in Hosea and Joel, you've not gone far enough. If you're in Malachi and Matthew, you've gone too far. If you're in Haggai, you're right next door. Okay, that helps me a lot. Zephaniah, and we're going to be there in a moment. But first, I want to talk to you one more time. Actually, two more times, because we'll do this again next week. I want to talk to you one more time today about the Hobbit. And we've been reading little bits and pieces of the story so far. Today, we're going to go back in the story. Okay, I guess you could call it a flashback. The part I want to talk about to you this morning takes place after Thorin and Bilbo and the rest of the dwarves left the Shire, but long before they ever made it to Lonely Mountain and the lair of Smaug. Thorin and Bilbo and the dwarves, even Gandalf, are making their way towards Lonely Mountain. They've left the house of Elrond. They've passed into what Tolkien calls the Wild. They've gone over the edge of the Wild. They're into uncharted territory. They're in the midst of the mountains, and there in the mountains, they find themselves caught in a thunder battle. Not a thunderstorm so much. It's even worse than a thunderstorm. They find themselves caught in a thunder battle as the mountains themselves come to life and begin hurling stones at each other in this mighty battle. And they're looking for a way to get out of it, and somebody notices up ahead there's a cave, and they go to this cave that appears to be uninhabited. It appears to be unused, and they seek shelter there. Bedding down for the night, they begin going to sleep. And as the company is there in this cave sleeping, and the storm is raging outside, Bilbo finds himself dreaming. And in his dream, there's this crack that begins to open up in the back of the cave. And Bilbo rolls over and he rubs his eyes, and suddenly he realizes that it wasn't a dream, that this is actually happening. They've stumbled into the secret entrance to a warren of tunnels inhabited by a group of goblins. And the goblins, coming out to find a company of dwarves sleeping on their front porch, immediately begin to take them captive. Bilbo barely has time to utter a cry of alarm, a cry of warning, before the goblins are upon them, and the dwarves find themselves tied up, and Bilbo and Thorin and the rest are being dragged through the tunnels to stand trial before the great goblin. And as bad as that sounds, what makes it worse is that Gandalf, their wizard, their leader, their protector, Gandalf, is nowhere to be found. Gandalf has disappeared. So the goblins bring them to the great goblin, the king of the goblins under the mountain, and here's what happens. There in the shadows, on a large flat stone, sat a tremendous goblin with a huge head, and armed goblins were standing around him, carrying the axes and bent swords that they use. And in case you didn't know what goblins were, Tolkien explains, goblins are cruel, wicked, and bad-hearted. They make no beautiful things, but they make many clever ones. They can tunnel and mine as well as any but the most skilled dwarves when they take the trouble, though they are usually untidy and dirty. Hammers, axes, swords, daggers, pickaxes, tongs, and also instruments of tortures they make very well, or get other people to make to their design. Prisoners and slaves that have to work till they die for want of air and light. It is not unlikely that they have invented some of the machines that have since troubled the world, especially the ingenious devices for killing large numbers of people at once. For wheels and engines and explosions always delighted them. And also not working with their own hands more than they could help. But in those days, and in those wild parts, they had not advanced, as it is called, so far. They did not hate dwarves especially, no more than they hated everybody and everything, and particularly the orderly and prosperous. In some parts, wicked dwarves had even made alliances with them, but they held a special grudge against Thorin's people because of the war which you have heard mentioned, but which does not come into this tale. And anyway, goblins don't care who they catch, as long as it is done smart and secret, and the prisoners are not able to defend themselves. "Who are these miserable persons?" said the great goblin. "Dwarves, and this," said one of the drivers, pulling Bilbo's chain so that he fell forward onto his knees. "We found them sheltering in our front porch." "What do you mean by it?" said the great goblin, turning to Thorin. "Up to no good, I'll warrant. Spying on the private business of my people, I guess. Thieves, I shouldn't be surprised to learn. Murderers and friends of elves, not unlikely. Come, what have you got to say?" "Thorin the dwarf at your service," he replied, but it really was just merely a polite nothing. "Of the things which you suspect and imagine, we had no idea at all. We sheltered from a storm in what seemed a convenient cave and unused. Nothing was further from our thoughts than inconveniencing goblins in any way whatever." That part was true enough.
Said the great goblin, "so you say. Might I ask what you were doing up in the mountains at all? Where you were coming from? Where you were going to? In fact, I should very like to know all about you. Not that it will do you much good, Thorin Oakenshield.
I know too much about your folk already. But let's have the truth, or I will prepare something particularly uncomfortable for you.
We were on our journey to visit our relatives, our nephews and nieces, and first, second, and third cousins, and the other descendants of our grandfathers who live on the east side of these truly hospitable mountains," said Thorin, not quite knowing what to say at all, in a moment when obviously the exact truth would not do at all.
"He's a liar, O truly tremendous one," said one of the drivers. "Several of our people were struck by lightning in the cave when we invited these creatures to come below. Now they are dead as stones. Also, he has not explained this."
And he held out the sword which Thorin had worn, the sword which came from the troll's lair. The great goblin gave a truly awful howl of rage when he looked at it. And all his soldiers gnashed their teeth, clashed their shields, and stamped. They knew the sword at once. It had killed hundreds of goblins in its time, when the fair elves of Gondolin hunted them in the hills, or did battle before their walls. They called it Orcrist, Goblin Cleaver, but the goblins simply called it Biter, and they hated it, and hated worse anyone that carried it.
"Murderers and elf friends!" the great goblin shouted. "Slash them, beat them, bite them, gnash them! Take them away to dark holes full of snakes! Never let them see light again!"
And he was in such a rage that he jumped off his seat and himself rushed at Thorin with his mouth open. Just at that moment, all the lights in the cavern went out. The great fire went off, poof, into a tower of blue, glowing smoke right up to the roof that scattered piercing white sparks all among the goblins. The yells and yammering, croaking, gibbering and jabbering, howls, growls and curses, shrieking and striking that followed were beyond description. Several hundred wild cats and wolves being roasted slowly alive together would not have compared with it. The sparks were burning holes in the goblins, and the smoke that now fell from the roof made the air too thick for even their eyes to see through. Soon they were falling over one another and rolling in heaps on the floor, biting and kicking and fighting as if they'd all gone mad. And suddenly a sword? It's an interesting word. Suddenly a sword flashed in its own light. Bilbo saw it go right through the great goblin as he stood dumbfounded in the middle of the rage. And he fell dead, and the goblin soldiers fled before the sword, shrieking into the darkness. The sword went back into its sheath.
"Follow me, quick!"
said a voice, fierce and quiet. And before Bilbo understood what had happened, he was trotting along again as fast as he could down more dark passages, with the yells of the goblin hall growing fainter behind him. A pale light was leading them on.
"Quicker, quicker!" said the voice. "The torches will soon be relit."
"Half a minute," said Dory, who was at the back next to Bilbo and a decent fellow. He made the hobbit scramble up on his shoulders as best he could with his tight hands, and then off they all went at a run, with a clink clink of chains, and with many a stumble since they had no hands to steady themselves with. And not for a long while did they stop, and by that time they must have been right down to the very mountain's heart. Then Gandalf lit up his wand. Of course it was Gandalf, but just then they were too busy to ask how he got there. It's one of my favorite passages in The Hobbit. When everything looks dark and hopeless, Gandalf is gone, goblins surround them, and then suddenly help appears. In fact, I chose this passage because it illustrates what Tolkien says is the most powerful aspect of fairy stories, of this type of tale. In literary terms, a catastrophe, put on our English thinking caps, a catastrophe in literary terms is the overturning, the final unraveling of a plot, especially associated with tragedies. Now, we think catastrophe, when we think of a catastrophe, the thing we think is something is so awful that there's no other word to describe it, right? But in literary terms, it is a plot device. In Greek, catastrophe literally means to turn over, to flip upside down. And there is a point in the story where the story flips upside down. And sometimes that's a very bad thing. Think about Romeo and Juliet. Are you familiar at all with the story of Romeo and Juliet? The catastrophe takes place, and typically does, very close to the end. It's after the climax, and typically in a plot, right before the final denouement, the final tying up of loose ends, so to speak. The catastrophe in Romeo and Juliet is when Juliet is laying there sleeping, but apparently dead because of some poison, some potion she drank. And Romeo, who has been gone, comes back and finds his beloved and assumes that she is dead, and himself grabs a vial of poison and drinks it and dies there on the spot. And then Juliet begins to wake up and looks and sees Romeo dead and grabs a knife and commits suicide. That's a catastrophe. All of a sudden, the plot turns for the worse. It looked like they had a plan, they looked like they had a way of escape, but all of a sudden everything gets turned upside down. It's a very bad thing. However, not every literary catastrophe is a bad thing. Not every overturning is bad news. In fact, when times are the darkest, and there seems to be no hope, oddly appropriate for this week, when times are the darkest and there seems to be no hope, a reversal becomes a good thing. And Tolkien himself invented a word to describe this kind of overturning. This isn't just a catastrophe, this is a eucatastrophe. Eu is the Greek prefix for good. Eucharist is communion, when we give thanks for the good gifts God has given us. Eu, good, charis, gifts. A eucatastrophe is an overturning, a reversal for the good. And Tolkien actually wrote an entire essay where he argued that the eucatastrophe, this good turn, is where the true power of the fairy story lies. Now I want to think about what happens. I want you to think about what happens when a story makes a sudden turn for the better. The result of eucatastrophe is something Tolkien called gloria. Yeah, the same gloria in Excelsis Deo that the angels sang. Gloria is the sudden joy that comes when deliverance is realized. When things looked hopeless, when it seemed like there was no way out, when you were surrounded and doomed, and all of a sudden God intervened, or something intervened, and the story turned upside down, and there was hope where previously there was none, the result is joy! Gloria! Tolkien, in his essay on fairy stories, writes, "It is the mark of a good fairy story, of the higher or more complete kind, that however wild its events, however fantastic or terrible its adventures, it can give to child or man that hears it, when the turn comes, a catch of the breath, a beat and a lifting of the heart, near or indeed accompanied by tears, as keen as that is given in any form of literary art. That sudden, unexpected joy, the result of you catastrophe, is gloria. And the report of you catastrophe, telling about the turn, telling about the transformation, the report of you catastrophe is something the church has long called evangelium, the good news. And at its core, that's what the gospel is. When things look their darkest, when there was no hope, God intervened, and now there is a way out, and that is good news. Evil has been defeated. Life has triumphed. Death itself is dead. That's good news. That's gospel. And the reason I love The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings is because they understand the power of glory and gospel. The power of fairy story lies in the way it reflects primary truth. You see, the cry of Gloria in Middle Earth is an echo of the great Gloria that was first sung by angels in the skies over Bethlehem and is ultimately found on the lips of every creature in all creation in John's Apocalypse. It is glory to God in the highest. Let there be honor and glory and power to Him who sits on the throne. The power of the fairy tale is that it knows the truth and reflects that truth. Tolkien writes later on in that essay on fairy stories, "The birth of Christ is the eucatastrophe of man's history, and the resurrection is the eucatastrophe of the story of the incarnation. The story begins and ends in joy." Begins and ends in joy. And it has preeminently the inner consistency of reality. There is no tale told. There is no tale ever told that men would rather find was true, and none which so many skeptical men have accepted as true on its own merits. To reject it leads either to sadness or to wrath. The gospel is glory and good news. Now, with that in mind, okay, with that framework, I want to turn to the book of Zephaniah. Zephaniah is a prophet you might not be very familiar with. He's part of the book of the 12. He's part of the 12 minor prophets at the end of what we call the Old Testament. In our canon. And it's a very small book, only exactly three chapters long. But I want to introduce you to this prophecy of Zephaniah today. Zephaniah was a prophet in Judah, the southern kingdom, during the 600s BC, and he was a member of the royal family. Zephaniah chapter 1, verse 1 says, "The word of the Lord that came to Zephaniah, son of Cushi," never heard of him, "son of Gedaliah," never heard of him, "the son of Amariah," never heard of him, "the son of Hezekiah," oh yeah, we heard of him. Hezekiah was one of the kings of Jerusalem. So Zephaniah is not only a prophet, he is a cousin to the current king, a member of the royal family. During Zephaniah's life, the northern kingdom has been conquered by the Assyrians, and the Babylonians are threatening to invade. Verse 1 of his prophecy says he ministered during the reign of Josiah, the son of Ammon, king of Judah. That lets us know that his ministry took place during one of the darkest moments in Jerusalem's history. Hezekiah, his great-great-grandpa, Hezekiah had been a righteous king who sought to eliminate idolatry in Judah. He was one of the reformers that sought to drive the worship of Canaanite gods out of Jerusalem. But Hezekiah eventually dies, and his son Manasseh becomes king. And Zephaniah grew up during the reign of Manasseh. And one of the things the Bible tells us about Manasseh is that Manasseh was one of Jerusalem's most wicked kings. Everything Hezekiah did right, Manasseh did wrong. He undid the reforms of his fathers. He brought idols, set up idols in the temple in Jerusalem itself. He executed anyone who spoke out against his idolatry. The Bible tells us he even sacrificed his own son to the pagan god Molech in the Valley of Hinnom outside of Jerusalem. The book of Chronicles tells us that eventually Manasseh repents. Later in life, he repents for the evil he's done, but in many ways, it was too late. Manasseh's son, Amon, was king for only 2 years, and he was so inept and corrupt that his own servants assassinated him. Anyone would be better than this guy. Let's get him out of the way. And so Zephaniah's ministry took place in the early years of the boy King Josiah's reign. Little Josiah was only 8 years old when his father Amon was assassinated. He became king and his advisors took over. And during the early years of Josiah's reign, it was unclear which direction Israel was going to go. Were they going to return to the reforms of Hezekiah, or were they going to continue down the wicked path of Manasseh and Amon? It's a dark time in Israel's history. But as bad as things were, it was about to get worse. And Zephaniah announced the coming of God's judgment. Zephaniah chapter 1 verse 2. Pretty sweeping terms here, literally. He says, "I will sweep away everything from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. I will sweep away both men and animals. I will sweep away the birds of the air and the fish of the sea, and the wicked will only have heaps of rubble when I cut off man from the face of the earth, declares the Lord." It's your typical really happy, feel-good kind of message, isn't it? I'm about to wipe it all out. I'm about to wipe it all out, God says. And unless anyone think that this day of the Lord is good news, Zephaniah clarifies later on in verse 14, he says, "The great day of the Lord is near, near and coming quickly. Listen, the cry on the day of the Lord will be bitter, the shouting of the warrior there. That day will be a day of wrath, a day of distress and anguish, a day of trouble and ruin, a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and blackness, a day of trumpet and battle cry against fortified cities and against the corner towers. And I will bring distress on the people, and they will walk like blind men because they've sinned against the Lord." Yeah, it was dark times in Jerusalem when Zephaniah was a prophet. Zephaniah proceeds in the next chapter and a half to announce judgment, to announce the judgment of God against all of Jerusalem's enemies. And he works his way right around the country. He starts in Philistia. In chapter 2, verse 4, he says, "Gaza will be abandoned, Ashkelon will be left in ruins. At midday, Ashdod will be emptied, and Ekron will be uprooted." But it's not just Philistia. He goes on to pronounce God's judgment against Moab and Ammon. He says, "I've heard the insults of Moab and the taunts of the Ammonites who insulted my people and made threats against their land." And it's not just these close countries, it's the faraway countries too. In chapter 2, verse 12, he says, "You too, O Cushites, people of the area we would now call Ethiopia, you too, O Cushites, will be slain by my sword." And it's not just the weak countries, it's even the powerful countries that God judges. He says in verse 13, "God will stretch out his hand against in the north and destroy Assyria, leaving Nineveh utterly desolate and dry as the desert." God announces judgment against all the people of the known world at that time. And then, just to make sure no one assumes Jerusalem is spared, Zephaniah begins and ends his judgment with a warning for the people of Judah. Chapter 3, verse 6, Zephaniah, speaking on behalf of God, says, "I have cut off nations, their strongholds are demolished, I have left their streets deserted with no one passing through. Their cities are destroyed. No one will be left, no one at all. And I said to the city, talking about Jerusalem, I said to the city, surely you will fear me and accept correction. Then her dwelling would not be cut off, nor my punishments come upon her. But they were still eager to act corruptly in all they did. God says, you'd assume, seeing the way I punished all these other nations, my own people, the people of Jerusalem, would do the right thing. But no, they just want to keep going in their wickedness, keep following after their idolatry. It is a dark day for Judah and Jerusalem. But then, just when the prophecy becomes its darkest, there is in the prophecy of Zephaniah a sudden reversal. In Tolkien's terms, there is a eucatastrophe in the book of Zephaniah itself. In fact, the shift is so abrupt that there are a lot of smart guys who've written pretty important books, a lot of commentators who've read this and studied this and said, I can't see how Zephaniah could get from here to here so fast. Somebody must have come along afterward and added this part to the book of Zephaniah. I don't believe that personally at all. But they say it's so sudden, it's so unexpected, it doesn't fit. But isn't that how God works? Just when it's darkest, just when it seems most hopeless, that God breaks in with the light of hope. And Zephaniah writes, follow along with me, verse 14, chapter 3. Zephaniah writes, sing, O daughter of Zion. Shout aloud, O Israel. Be glad and rejoice with all your heart, O daughter of Jerusalem. The Lord has taken away your punishment. He has turned back your enemy. The Lord, the King of... Catch this. The Lord, the King of Israel, is with you. Never again will you fear any harm. On that day they will say to Jerusalem, do not fear, O Zion. Do not let your hands hang limp. The Lord your God is with you, and He is mighty to save. And He will take great delight in you, and He will quiet you with His love. And He will rejoice over you with singing. Zephaniah says, all of a sudden, when it looks darkest, when it looks most hopeless, the whole story is going to turn upside down. That prophecy we just read contains a call to rejoice. He says, sing, O daughter of Israel. Shout, O Israel. It also contains a beautiful picture of God's love. Zephaniah 3, verse 17 is one of my favorite prophecies in the Old Testament. And the picture it has of God, it says God isn't just with you. God delights over you. He delights over you. And then there's that part where it says He will quiet you with His love. Someone who studies Hebrew will tell you that most of the time, that verb quiet isn't something that you do to somebody else, it's something you yourself do. Quite honestly, I wonder if the better translation isn't not that He will quiet you, but that He Himself loves you so much that He Himself grows quiet. You take God's words away when He looks at you. He loves you that much. When He finally finds His voice, He begins to sing. He begins to sing over you with joy. Love that picture of God. But best of all, it contains a promise of God's presence. The Lord your God is with you, and He is mighty to save. This is the eucatastrophe of history. This is the Gloria Evangelii, the glory of the gospel. This is it. The Lord your God is with you. Think back to the story we read earlier. Imagine the excitement of the dwarves when Gandalf revealed himself. Imagine the piercing joy, the catch of breath, the race of the heart, the thrill of hope. We're not alone. We've not been abandoned. Gandalf is with us. And yet that Gloria, as great as it might have been for that hobbit and dwarves, that Gloria is nothing but the softest echo, Nothing but the faintest reverberation of the great Gloria announced by prophets, heralded by angels, and sung by all creation itself at the end of time. Glory to God in the highest, because God is with us. God is with us. What does it mean to say, the Lord your God is with you? This is the good news. It means that in the midst of temptation, God is with us. The author of Hebrews says the high priest we have in Jesus Christ isn't the kind of high priest that doesn't know what it's like to be tempted. He has been tempted in every way just as we are, yet he was without sin. He's walked with you through the times of temptation. When you're being tempted, remember this. God is with us. It means in the season of suffering, God is with us. Oh, one of the most powerful descriptions of Jesus in my mind is in Hebrews chapter 5, verse 8, where it says, even though he was a son, he learned obedience from what he suffered. Now, I don't think that means that Jesus had to learn how to obey God. Do you? The Bible just, Hebrews just said, he was tempted in every way, yet he was without sin. Trust me, Jesus knew how to obey. But Jesus also knew how much it costs sometimes to obey. Obedience didn't come easy. He paid the price for obedience. He's walked with us through the season of suffering. And in the midst of our suffering, the glory of the gospel is God is with us. It also means that in the valley of loneliness, God is with us. Isaiah says he had no beauty or majesty that should attract us to him. Nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. Instead, he was despised and rejected by men. A man of sorrows, familiar with suffering. Like one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised. And we esteemed him not. Jesus knew what it meant to be in the valley of loneliness. 40 days and nights in the wilderness, wrestling with God in prayer, alone. Loneliness in the Garden of Gethsemane, gathering his three closest friends to spend the night watching and praying with him, yet they keep falling asleep. Having to bear the burden of my sin alone. And it wasn't just there. Jesus was surrounded by great crowds, huge multitudes, but there were times I know of loneliness. John chapter 2 tells us of one. Crowds were coming to him. He was healing people. They loved what he was doing. They loved his healing. They loved his miracles. But he says Jesus would not entrust himself to them because he knew all men. He knew they didn't love him, they just loved his magic tricks. Jesus knows what it means to walk through the valley of loneliness. And in our times of loneliness, this is the glory of the gospel. God is with us. It also means that in the face of evil, God is with us. A school shooting is nothing foreign to Jesus Christ, whose birth was met by the slaughter of innocents. He knows what it means to face evil. He knows what it means to hear that news report that something unspeakable has happened. He was there with his disciples ministering one day when some people came up to him and said, Did you hear what Pilate did in Jerusalem? The way he slaughtered the Galileans who'd come up to Jerusalem to worship there and mingled their blood together with the sacrifices. Did you hear about that? Jesus not only knew what it was like to hear the reports of unspeakable violence, ultimately he became the victim of hatred and violence himself. Stretched out on a criminal's cross, left to die, accompanied only by the thieves they'd hung to his left and right. In the face of evil, God is with us. And it also means in the coming resurrection, we can be with God. Colossians chapter 3 says, "You died, and your life is now hidden with Christ in God. And when Christ, who is your life, appears, you also will appear with Him in glory." This is the glory of the gospel. This is the good news in the middle of dark, hopeless times. This is the glory of the gospel. God is with us. I can't say it any better than Charles Spurgeon did years ago in a sermon. I'm going to watch a brief video here. Remember, this is the good news. God is with us.